Okay. You're live now.
Okay, we're back. And also, after we made the high-speed pass, we slowed down, put the gear and flaps down, and then we flew on a slow pass. And then whenever we went ahead and we lit the burners, we picked up the gear and the flaps, and we climbed up to altitude, and we went home. And that was my first ride in France. And I didn't have any clue where we went. I was just flying his wing all the way down there and back. So anyway, after that, one of the first things that we did after I'd gotten checked out flying in the local area, went down to Tripoli, down to Wheelis Air Force Base, and that's where we went down to get nuclear qualified. And so I was down there getting nuclear qualified, and our president, John F. Kennedy, got assassinated. And we were at the officers' club eating our evening meal when the waiter came in. He didn't speak much English at all, and he was trying to tell us that the president was very serious. And then he came back a little bit, and he told us he was mort. He was dead. And so we didn't have a clue what was going on.
Oh, wow.
So we went ahead and went down to the flight line, got our airplanes all, set them up on alert so that at a moment's notice we could be going back into France, because we didn't know if that was the start of something. And, we were in the Cold War then, and we were already checked out on our wartime mission. So, anyway, we were down there a week, and we didn't have anything to do, so played the first two rounds of golf, and there wasn't any grass anywhere, and the greens were oiled down, and a guy was going to teach me how to play golf, and he swatted that ball about 10 times, and he picked it up right there and put it back on the tee 9 of the times. And I says, "Fella, you showed me how to hit this ball, and how about me taking a shot at it?" And I did what he told me to do, and when I hit that ball, I thought old Ben Hogan was in my shoes. That ball took off. Not that I'd worked for the highway department using a yo-yo or the thing that you cut weeds with, and I'd been chopping wood ever since I was about 12 years old, so I knew how to swing stuff. And so anyway, I think I shot a 48 that day, but the only problem was every time I'd find my ball, it was up on a tuft of grass because old Siddiqui had found it first. And on that last round, I was about 100 yards out from the green, and he gave me the putter. And I hit that ball, and you don't know what it's going to do, but it did hit on that the green, which was hard as the pavement, bounced over there, hit on the pavement, hit a cinder block wall, bounced back across the pavement, and came back and laid up there next to the pin. And so anyway, that was my first experience with golf. We played 18 holes all told, and I retired after that. But anyway, went back to France, and we flew all over the free Europe up there. And in the summertime, we could fly just about any place because the weather would let us. But in the wintertime, the weather stays socked in over there for months at times. And so we'd go down to Spain at Morón, Spain, and would fly out of there to keep our proficiency and all. And then also, I got to fly in the Alps down there. Thing that most people don't know, the base of the Alps are about 1,000 feet, and some of the tops are up around 15,000. So that gives you 14,000 feet, and our airplane would not climb up that unless you did some turning and maneuvering, because you couldn't just pull the nose up and it wouldn't go over the mountains. And so that was really interesting down there, and flying in that area. And we got to fly over in England and all Germany and Belgium and all those places, and got to see, fly up and down the rivers over there and see all the castles and all the beautiful things. And it was just really delightful. But in the wintertime, you'd go 3 months, and on the ground, you would never see the sun. And when we left there in 1968, in July, the temperature never had gotten up to 60 degrees. And it was in August before it got up to 60 degrees that year. So anyway, if you check with Mitchell and Michael, they can tell you about going to the Reims Grand Prix on the 4th of July, and everybody had on parkas, and everybody got so cold they went to the car and was running the heater, and it was the 4th of July. And
it was cold.
It was really cold. One of the neat things was that we had some French friends that her father was the third largest champagne exporter in France. They had chateaus in 4 different areas of France. And the times we'd go there, they had people there that they'd serve you a meal. And they were there all the time to take care of whoever showed up. And their garden out there was like the Tivoli Gardens. It's just beautifully manicured. But anyway,
that was their names?
Joanne and, that was the Plazes, Joanne and Monsieur Plaz, and Michelle and Roger. Man, his last name leaves me right now. But anyway, their friends were people that had quite a bit of money, and it was just very interesting to be with them. And the houses over there don't have any front yard, a lot of them, and the sidewalk is not but about 4 feet wide, and then you come to the house. And but anyway, once you go in the house, you'd think you was in a different world. And in their place, they had horses, and it was built in it's about a half a block was their property. And when you went into the backyard, the first thing you ran into was a compost pile. And then they had the barns for the horses, and then they had their tractors in there also. And it was really interesting, because their lifestyle was quite a bit different from ours. But we really enjoyed. They were friends for 3 years, and they had children about the same age as ours. And first time we was out there, what's the little boy's name?
Don't remember.
Anyway, I said, "En garde." I didn't know that was a French word. And he stomped his foot about twice, and he stabbed me with his épée. So anyway, it was very interesting. And from our time in France, we got to go skiing over in Germany, and went up into the Alps, and where they had the 36 Olympics, got to ski down beside that Olympic jump. And there's stories about that. But took the boys up there on top of the mountain. And man, was it cold. You rode a cog train. And about halfway up the mountain, it went into a tunnel. And it went round and round in the mountain until you came out very near the top. And the boys, they got to ski I trust that they enjoyed it also. And we got to take a vacation 1 year, and we went down into Italy, and we got to see the Leaning Tower of Pisa and go walk up it, and out on the beach. And Michael, the oldest son, told his mama, says, "Mama, there isn't anybody down here that knows you. why don't you get you a bathing suit like all of them have? Because she was the only one-piece bathing suit on the beach. And Michael was trying to get his mother to be in vogue with all the rest of them. So anyway, that, and we went through Monaco, and that's very beautiful, and drove the course where they run the Monaco Grand Prix. It's down there on the water and runs up on the side of the hill. And that was very interesting. Well, that's a short trip through North Carolina and Lone, France.
And I remember you talking about one time you were in France and you couldn't find airport to land at. It was, you were running low on fuel and the ceiling was too low. Is that right?
Well, that's mostly right. Here we are. We're on reconnaissance alert, and we're having an operational readiness inspection. And we belong to NATO, and so they come over there and they check out everything. And I happened to be on alert that day for visual reconnaissance, and they launch us before daylight, or just about daylight, and the weather is really bad. We had to have 300-foot ceiling and 1 mile visibility before we could take off. But here we're out there in the dark, and they blow the horn, and away we go. And so I fly over to the eastern France, where I'm supposed to let down, make an instrument approach, and then depart visual and fly my low-level visual route to a target over there in Germany. Well, I get over there, and I call him up and says, I'd like to get clearance for penetration. And he says, we're not going to clear you because we're below minimums over here. I says, okay. And so I'm in a holding pattern up there, so I get on the radio, and I call over to our command post. And I tell them, says, hey, it's below minimums over here, and I'm headed back home. And so they says, okay. Well, there was five of us up there that day that they'd launched. And when we got back home, guess what? They were below minimums also.
So that means you can't land?
You can't land. Well, legally, you can't land. Because when you're coming in at 175 knots and you get down to 300 feet and a mile visibility, you don't have much reaction time. And so anyway, and the runways we flew off of wasn't but 150 feet wide, and they were 7,200 feet long. And so whenever we get there, come to find out, I've got four more guys up there in the holding pattern, but I'm not the number one guy to come down. And so this guy that was on alert with me.
So you're just waiting for the weather to clear up so you can land?
Well, we was going to go to our alternate. Well, first of all, I says, our alternate over in England, and they says, you're not going over there because they're below minimums. All of Europe was socked in. And they had launched us up there, and there was no place that we could go. We had enough fuel to go to Spain, but that wasn't that diminished very quickly. Once you burn up some more gas, we couldn't have made it down there. So anyway, they says, y'all stand by. And a little bit, they had the wing commander up there in the command in the control tower, and the wing commander says, I command you to land here. And the guy that's first in line, he says, I'm departing 20,000 feet. And so we're staying with him on his GCA frequencies, listening to him. And whenever he's getting on final approach, he's out at 1 mile. And they keep talking to him. And they keep talking him down. And they finally ask him, says, are you down? And he wasn't answering them. But anyway, he landed, and he finally came up on the other channel. And let me tell you, we were relieved whenever the first guy made it. And so then that sent the next guy down. And when it came my turn, I was able to come in and was able to make an uneventful landing. But anyway, all of Europe was socked in that we could use to land. And we were more familiar with our local area than going someplace else where you're not familiar and when they're down to that same kind of weather. But anyway, that's one of those times that you just wonder, what are we going to do? What are we doing up here? And I remembered the time that I was out chopping cotton when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And these guys from Stanford were flying their BT-13s, learning how to fly. And I'd look up there, and it's hot and sweaty, and I'm chopping that cotton, and I'd think, man, I wish I was up there with, and that guy was down here chopping this cotton. And I've had numerous occasions over there in France that when I was up there, that same thought came by. I said, man, I wish I was down there and that other guy's up here, because it looked like we was going to have to jump out. But anyway, the Lord got us through all those times, and it was just amazing.
So if the airport had been just completely fogged in, you would have had to bail out?
Well, that if you didn't make it, you would. You'd make a low pass, and if you didn't see it, and you make till you run out of gas, and then you jump out. And flying the fighters, all you had to have was 20 minutes of fuel left when you got to 20,000 feet over the base. And guess what? You're going to use about 1,000 of those. Well, you had to have 2,000 pounds. You'd use about 1,000 pounds of that just making an approach. So once you committed to go down, you're going to land there. That's because you didn't have enough fuel to go anyplace else. And you're up there all by yourself and switching channels sometimes when you've got to go to six different figures and remember what they are and you can't see them and you're flying in the weather and it's at night and in formation. And then you got to remember how to put it in that manual frequency. And those kind of things remind me that I'm glad I'm not trying to do that at my age. And anyway, flying over there was really interesting, and we got to do a lot of things, got to see all of the country and the beauty and the majesty. And flying down in North Africa, you'd be out there flying over the desert, and you'd run across these columns that made out of marble, and they'd look to be 20, 30, 40 feet tall. And you'd see what the Romans did. Wow. And all of that. And we went down to Tripoli one time, and I didn't ever want to go back there again. If you stuck your hand out of the window, if you had a watch on it, it would not be there when you pulled your arm in. And it is just amazing. You're talking about darkness. And but anyway, it's a good place to fly because it didn't ever rain. And we didn't have any sandstorms while we were there. And Benghazi was just the next town over from where we were. And, man, you don't want to get me on that or what should have happened at Benghazi, because we had a lot of assets could have gotten there in an hour or two. We could have come down from France. It wouldn't have been but 2 hours to get there. And if you just fly over those guys and put a bunch of loud noise and a whole lot of black smoke on them, it'll make them forget about fighting and make them want to hide. Couldn't hurt them anymore, but you could sure scare them. So that got us up to our tour of duty in France. And from there, went to the command and staff college. I was a captain when I went there, and I made major when I got there.
So where we was lived that?
In Montgomery, Alabama. And while I was there, I got to be a flight instructor. And I hadn't flown a T-33 in 4 years. And they put me in there and says, there you go. And so we'd go out in the afternoon and come back at night. That was one day a week. And we went to class 8 hours a day and then went to working on a master's degree at night for 4 hours one night a week. And so that was really interesting.
At school to learn to be a major?
No, it's for command, to be a command of an organization or to be a staff officer. It's just an education. I'd already been to the squadron officer school, and that was down at Montgomery also. And so this is just part of the career ladder that you're supposed to go to. And the Air War College is the last school that they have. And being as how I was already getting ready to retire. And what happened when I went to command and staff is really interesting, because I had never had any staff jobs and anything, and a lot of that was about regulations and stuff that I'd never been exposed to. And they give you an entrance exam down there to see where they're going to put you. Well, in my case, English is not my strong course, but by the time I took that test, going in there, I went through an English self-study course of 3,200. And I did that over the holidays there, over Labor Day. And it just greatly improved my English and grammar. And anyway, I scored in the bottom third of all the people that took the test. Now, one of the guys in one of my seminars was the intelligence officer at the Pentagon that was briefing Kennedy on what was happening down in Cuba during the Cuban crisis. And, you know, we've got all kinds of guys, fighter pilots, bomber pilots, navigators, staff people. And we even had a WAF in our section one time. But the thing of it was, my grades, after they put me in a section, the guy came in and at my first interview, he says, "You're like a basketball player playing way over his head." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, you scored in the bottom third, but says you up in the top third of all this stuff." And he was concerned that I was way over my head. But anyway, it turned out that stuff that they tested on was stuff that I knew very little about. They didn't ask me anything about flying and the regulations of flying and all that stuff that I thought was really important. Because if you don't know your dash one, that's how your airplane operates, and things happen, you can get killed real quick. So anyway, I went through that school, and the kids were down there in Montgomery, and the exciting thing, we lived one house away from the black ghetto. And I could tell you stories about the oldest son. He found out what they call those black people, because he had never seen a whole lot of black people. And anyway, that's another story, probably for another time. And I was in the 101, and there wasn't any way to get out of that normally. Everybody that was in the 101 had to go back, because they had a critical shortage of the recce pilots, because they'd lost quite a few of them. And the 101, like I say, the restrictions on that to fly it, because it had design limitations, you had to have 2,500 hours of jet time before they'd even let you go through their school. So they had a window open for about 3 days that you could volunteer to go to F-4s and go to Vietnam. So I went ahead and I volunteered for that. And
so is Mom excited about that, or
she wasn't, you know, I was going to go anyway.
Okay.
And it was better. I was a whole lot happier going in a F-4 where you carry bombs and a gun and missiles and rockets and all that stuff. And so she was pleased that I got out of the, because, and there's two people in the airplane. In the 101, you're there by yourself. We lost so many of the 101s over there in Vietnam. They were going out by themselves, and they didn't ever know what happened to them. So they didn't know whether they was getting shot down or they ran into a thunderstorm or what. So that's when they started making them fly in a two-ship formation so that they knew, had a history of what happened to the airplanes.
So but, was the 101 a good plane? Or
It was a good airplane. It had two engines, and it had about 34,000 pounds of thrust, and it flew like an airplane, except for that pitch-up malfunction. And they never corrected that in the 101, but they did in the F-4. They put the tails down on the bottom of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and they put them down at, 60 degrees or so, so that it gives stability to the airplane. And anyway, I was real excited when I got to go to the F-4 because I was getting out of the 101 and I was going to get to fly fighters that had guns and rockets and bullets on it, and that's what I'd always wanted to do. So it was kind of a relief to all of us when I got to do what I signed up to do quite a few years mm-hmm. before. So anyway, went to George out in California. And, you know, coming from France, I thought, you know, I've seen everything, but I hadn't been to South California. And we were out there in the, we were there in 68 and 69. In a short departure, we went to Disneyland out there, or Disney World. Didn't have a map, and the fog was so bad and the smog that we missed the turnoff going to the Disneyland, and we wound up in Watts. And this is right after they'd had all those riots out there. And guess what license plate we had on our white station wagon? Alabama. And I was going to go get some, stopped at a restaurant, and I was going to go get some information how to get out there to Disneyland. And looked in there, and there were no white people. So I got back in the car, and I turned around and headed back east. And we stopped at a gas station after a while. I asked, how do you get to Disneyland? He said, just go down this road about 15 miles, and you'll be there. So anyway, took the boys out there. They didn't want to go to Disneyland because they had more fun with the lizards that they had captured and living out there in the high mm-hmm. desert, had three horses. And I think they really enjoyed that time. Mm-hmm. And everybody's in the same boat. We're all going to war. And we've got our families with us. And we got in the F-4. And guess what kind of instructor they gave me? He is an Australian. All he had ever done had been air defense, air combat. And he didn't have but about 20 or 30 hours in the airplane. And so he had just gotten there, and I may have been his first student. I don't know. But anyway, went out and did the pre-flight on there, and I walked around the airplane, looked at everything I was supposed to, kicked the left nose gear. And I got in the airplane, and he wasn't getting in. I says, are you going to go with me? He says, you didn't pre-fly at the airplane. Yes, I did. And so anyway, we took off. And anyway, turned out he had really good eyesight. And I had 20/15 back then, and he probably had that or better. And if I ever wanted to go to war in air-to-air combat, I wanted either him on my wing or me on his wing, because we could see them quicker, and we didn't lose any of the battles that when we were fighting our other airplanes. But anyway, we got out there, and we got to flying and got to doing all that stuff, and it was really fun. And going out, one of the things that I enjoyed was the strafing. Because you get right down there, 35 feet was the minimum on a strafing run. Well, it was just all a lot of fun. And the air-to-air combat training, you read in the book how to do all these things. And then when it came time to do them, if you did what it said in the books. And one of the maneuvers I really remember was a rolling vertical scissor. And that's where the guy's on your tail, and you're pulling up into a loop, And when you get it going straight up, you got the burners going. And whenever he gets close to you, you pull the power back to idle and you drop the speed brakes. And the guy comes shooting out over your canopy and where you're looking at his canopy. And I never saw the airplane. My backseater kept telling me where he was and the position he was in. So I was just doing what the book said, and I did all that stuff. And sure enough, when I dropped the speed brakes and I turned my head back, there he went right over the top of us. And so anyway, he probably wasn't 30 feet from us. So
really?
Oh, yeah. This stuff's close. And so anyway, I thought, this stuff really does work. And because people that knew what they were doing is one that wrote the books, because they're the ones that lived. And a friend of mine that had just gotten back from Vietnam, he told me, says, buddy, don't listen to the guy that's got all the answers and the loudmouth. You just watch the guy that comes back every day. And says, you go over there and get in the corner with him, and you go up to him and says, how are you doing all this? And then you just pick his brain, because what he's doing is working. And I thought of that many times when I was over there in Vietnam. But anyway, we went to school out there and looking for a house. We looked at a bunch of houses. One of them had a swimming pool, and it had a two-car garage. And guess what was in the two-car garage? It was all swimming pool apparatuses to keep the pool going. And I thought, here we're going to be here 9 months, and I sure don't want to be having to take care of a pool. And so we looked at all these things, and we found a place that was an old cement factory previously, which had been subdivided. And a guy that was with the Sportsman Quartet had bought that place and had three houses, the big house where he lived, the foreman's house where we lived, and then they had another smaller house where another couple lived. And Jay and his wife had horses, and they had a bunch of kids too. So anyway, when we was asking them, where do you guys want to live? And you know what the boys told me? We want to live here because there's lots of lizards. And so anyway, and it was close to the base, and that worked out well. And really enjoyed the training out there. And we got air-to-air refueling, got to shoot AIM-7 missile at the night out over the Pacific. And, you know, we got to go out 29 palms out to their range and shoot up a bunch of cars that had been shot up before. And it's just a lot of fun. And that was getting me ready to go to Vietnam.
Well,